Dive into the Americas today with hosts Carl Meacham and Robert Funk for insights on U.S. Latin America relations and inter-American dynamics you won't find anywhere else. So welcome to Americas Today, where we dive deep into the issues shaping the Americas. Today, we're joined by Paul Angelo, the author of From Peril to Partnership, U.S. Security Assistance and the Bid to Stabilize Colombia and Mexico. And he is the director of the William J. Perry Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies. He's a good friend, and his book provides an in-depth look at the U.S.'s attempts to fight drug trafficking in Colombia and Mexico, highlighting the successes and challenges. You're not only on because you're a good friend, but because the book is very good, Paul. One of the issues that we want to talk about here is while Plan Colombia is seen as a relative success, and I think you highlight that in the book, the Merida Initiative in Mexico hasn't fared as well. I think your book focuses on how local politics and institutions have influenced these outcomes. And I think that's something that we'd love to explore a little bit more, but let me sort of open it to you to give us sort of the breaking down of Plan Colombia briefly and Merida, and what you think are the most, the core components of these plans, what they're aiming to achieve, and then we can take it from there. So Paul, the floor is yours. Welcome.
Great. Thanks so much, Carl. It's a pleasure to be on the Americas Today podcast, and a salute to you and the team at Global Americans for all the good work that you do in fostering dialogue across our shared neighborhood. And with that, and with the prompt that you provided me, I'll just start by explaining exactly what Plan Colombia and the Merida Initiative were, both for the United States and also for our partners in Colombia and Mexico. Plan Colombia and the Merida Initiative were the two most significant U.S. security assistance efforts in Latin America and the Caribbean in the 21st century. And they were initiatives to support democratic partners in reforming and transforming their security and defense forces in ways that improve the provision of security, to improve local security outcomes for the citizens of Colombia and Mexico, reduce crime and violence, particularly transnational crime and violence, but also curb drug flows to the United States. Obviously, they were part of a supply side approach to dealing with the narcotics challenge, the transnational narcotics challenge that the United States has long deemed a national security threat. And so Plan Colombia, the Merida Initiative, were comprehensive and interagency effort to use security assistance as a means of fostering greater regional stability. And despite some initial skepticism during the negotiating phase of Plan Colombia, the Merida Initiative, by the time that they had been passed into law, they both enjoyed broad bipartisan support in the United States. Plan Colombia was signed into law in 2000 as a response to spiraling brazen attacks by illegal armed groups in Colombia, the FARC, the ELN, the AUC. Colombia at the time and to this day remains the number one cocaine producer in the world. And there was also at the time a real fear that Bogota would fall victim to revolutionary violence. The FARC were amassing forces on the outskirts of Bogota in the late 1990s, had taken over a number of Colombian military bases and police stations. And there was a broad consensus across Colombian society that security sector reform and the transformation of Colombia's security forces were the way out of that morass. Similarly, in 2006-2007, shortly after President Felipe Calderón in Mexico assumed the reins of the national executive, there was a spiraling of cartel violence, inter-cartel competition and violence across Mexico's national territory, but particularly in those cities and states along the border with the United States, where they're obviously very lucrative drug routes. And so Calderón, dealing with a mounting atomization of organized crime in Mexico and increasing co-optation of police forces across Mexico by organized crime, undertook a major security sector reform effort and sought support from the United States in order to finance that and help introduce new technology and equipment to take the fight to drug cartels. I think the spirit of collaboration and cooperation in both Pan-Colombia and the Merida Initiative is what makes them uniquely comparable case studies for an academic undertaking, as such was my book.
So thanks for that sort of very, very complete rundown. And it's clear from the book and from history, I guess, that Plan Colombia has been more successful. So you offer some, I guess, evidence as to why that was the case. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. Well, one of the big undertakings for the book, when I was conducting the research and surveying the existing academic and popular literature about Plan Colombia and the Merida Initiative, was that nearly every analysis of Plan Colombia evaluated it through exclusively counter-drug metrics. But I think as somebody who had previously, as a naval officer and as a representative of the U.S. Department of State in Latin America, the Caribbean, had worked on security assistance, I recognized that the conversation needed to go beyond the drug war. And I wanted to focus more pointedly on the institutional reform aspects of Plan Colombia and the Merida Initiative. And by evaluating Plan Colombia through that lens, we see a broad success because the Colombian security forces, the military and the police, over this span of just a little bit more than a decade, dramatically improved their professionalism, their effectiveness at providing security for Colombian citizens, and their accountability under the law. And so there was, I think, the strategic environment in which this happened as well, created a scenario in which Bogota and Washington found common cause. There was an alignment of strategic objectives in Plan Colombia. Plan Colombia was at once a counter-drug fight, a counter-insurgency campaign, a counter-terrorism campaign, an effort at consolidating Colombia's democracy, a state-building undertaking, and a stabilization mission. And in the same way that the United States understood Plan Colombia as the vehicle to accomplish all of those objectives, our partners in Bogota embraced a whole-of-government approach to dealing with the country's security crisis. And it was facilitated as well by three main factors, which comprise the three main sort of buckets of analysis that at the latter parts of my book that were present in Colombia but absent in Mexico, and I think contributed to a fairly underwhelming result in the Merida Initiative. Firstly, the involvement of the private sector in delivering resources, but also providing the oversight for security sector reform. Consensus among the major parties in the party system in Colombia on transforming the Ministry of Defense as the means of combating criminality and resurrecting the state throughout the national territory. And then thirdly, the institutional design aspects of the nature of the Colombia's security bureaucracy being a highly centralized one, in which decision-making as well was highly centralized. In Mexico, on the other hand, security throughout the Merida Initiative and to today abides by an electoral calculus. Security is a highly politicized issue, and that undercuts the possibility of continuity from one administration to the next. This is complicated by the fact that Mexico is also a federal system. So you have competition in elections at three levels of government. The federal system made it very difficult for the United States to coordinate a lot of its support programs, and the introduction of new technology and opportunities for education, training, and professionalism, simply because there were so many police forces throughout the national territory. There was a bifurcation or a division between the two secretariats for defense, the Sedena, which represents the Army and the Air Force, and SEMAR, which represents the Navy and the Marines. So that deconcentration and decentralization of the security sector firstly made it very difficult to coordinate the contours of the Merida Initiative, but also created more nodes of entry for cartels and gangs to engage in state capture. In Mexico, by contrast to the scenario in which we saw in Colombia, there's historic distrust between political and economic elites. They don't operate in the same circles. They don't come from the same sectors of society. Politically, political elites historically have tended to come from the middle class, whereas obviously economic elites are from the upper classes or the financial elites in the country and the big business owners. And so a lack of sort of isolation between these two groups historically has created distrust that was completely absent in the case of Colombia, where the private sector really did rally behind the national executive and Congress in financing the security sector reform effort that was undertaken.
Yeah, in the book you mentioned that these successes, and you've alluded to it some now, like of U.S.-led or funded programs, depends heavily on local politics and institutional frameworks. And a lot of that is sort of up in play all the time. Given this, like, how do you think the U.S. approach, or how should they approach these projects moving forward? Is there a playbook that you would identify for navigating institutional hurdles before there's the implementation of many of these programs? Things are very different in Colombia, for instance, now than they were during these, you know, Plan Colombia, and things are very different in Mexico as well. What do you think are sort of the contours that you can pick up from these experiences that could be applied to other countries, but also to the current situation in these countries?
So one of my big inspirations for writing the book to begin with is that I too often here in Washington, D.C., or in the U.S. foreign policy discourse, we assume that the United States is always in the driver's seat. And I wanted to write a book that put our partners back in the driver's seat and recognize the agency that they have in delivering on the promise of U.S. security assistance. And so if there's one big lesson from this book, it's that there are a lot of things that are outside of the control of Washington. Mm-hmm. And we have to, in constructing, designing, and then implementing is security assistance or foreign assistance writ large, we have to have the humility to accept that. And I think there are at sort of the margins in negotiating security assistance plans like Plan Colombia or the Merit Initiative, there are things that we can do to structure engagements in ways that cultivate greater political will on the side of our partners or in the receiving country. For instance, something like legislative review in order to reduce the chance of politicization or polarization surrounding security as we experienced in Mexico, as we see in Mexico today. Having put something like the Merida Initiative through a legislative review where you have parties from across the political spectrum voting on it and having a voting record of it, it prevents that support and the security strategies that evolve out of it from being so readily politicized. Likewise, the United States, with its unique credibility and economic position globally, in some countries might be able to court the private sector or create spaces for dialogue between the private sector and the public sector in countries where the two are operating in a siloed fashion, or creating guarantees perhaps for the private sector to ensure that oversight will be sufficient so that their resources will not be inappropriately used by government. And likewise, I think that even in highly decentralized security sector contexts like Mexico, where you have over 2,000 police agencies operating at three levels of government without a consistent or a commonly accepted chain of command and different standards of professionalism and recruitment and retention. I think what we learned in Mexico is that the United States could still identify those agencies or units that will have an outsized impact on security outcomes, to include things like financial intelligence units. When you're talking about counter-drug or counter-trafficking operations, there are always those people in society, participants in society, who are laundering money for organized crime outfits. And so financial intelligence units, in fact, helped deliver some of the most propitious victories during the course of the Merida Initiative. But I think the overall message that I would say is that the United States, in looking across the globe, we want to always have the opportunity to determine where we engage in security assistance. Sometimes our national security calculations will dictate that we have to be involved in, let's say, Afghanistan, let's say, Ukraine. But in in the scenarios in which we do have options and we're looking at partners who demonstrate political will, I think that's exactly where we need to concentrate our efforts and concentrate our resources, and recognizing that there are unique political moments that that have to be seized upon when they present themselves. And those national executives or the political context in a country that serves as a partner for us, when there's an alignment of vision amongst people and decision makers in a partner nation that has the long-term political stability and has improved governance at the heart of a governing vision, that's where the United States can minimize the risk that it would assume in administering a security assistance package.
Yeah, but you focused on something that's really important, which is to have the humility to understand that we can't control everything and that we have to work with our partners. And I think that's right on, but I'm sorry, Robert.
No, I think, so far everything that you've shared is very much sort of the lessons for the United States, how the United States should design policy. And I think one of the things that you mentioned is sort of this idea that, one size doesn't fit all. You have to kind of adapt your policy to the reality, to the local realities, to the local institutions, to the local elites, and so on. Yeah. What are the lessons? Obviously this issue is so top of mind in Latin America. That explains the success of Bukele in El Salvador and, Noboa is maybe, going in that direction. What do you think are the lessons for Latin American governments? What can they do to, on their end, because the things that you mentioned, obviously you could say, well, there could be better coordination between the private sector and the public sector. That's kind of probably easier said than done. But what do you think are the lessons for local governments in terms of what they should be doing?
I think the real lesson here is that in order to improve security outcomes in ways that are sustainable, particularly in critical violence scenarios like the scenario that presents itself in the countries of Central America or in Ecuador today, is that you have to make institutional investments. And those investments need to be generational in order to deliver long-term results and long-term national and regional stability. I also think that in addition to taking time, Plan Colombia demonstrated that it takes considerable resources, international partnership, a dialogue with civil society, and not just a national focus, but a regional focus, because at the end of the day, the criminal elements that are operating in a place like Ecuador or a place like Honduras or El Salvador have transnational links. And so the international partnership element of it is incredibly important. And on this note, I would say that this is where, Plan Ecuador very, very much could produce the kind of long-term sustainable victory over organized crime. And it could serve eventually as a model should the United States and alongside its Ecuadorian partners devote the sufficient resources to addressing the spiraling situation of dramatic violence that Ecuador today confronts. However, Ecuador is not Colombia. And I've heard a number of people in Ecuador say, well, Ecuador needs a Plan Colombia or a Plan Ecuador, and something that I myself have advocated for. However, I don't think that we can automatically assume that just because something worked in Colombia, it would work in Ecuador. The scenario in Ecuador is just so different from that in which Colombia found itself 20 years ago. Colombia was fighting a counterinsurgency and a counterterrorism campaign, whereas Ecuador today is working on dismantling transnational organized crime outfits. Drug cartels and gangs in Ecuador today operate with a degree of discretion that wasn't necessarily the case in Colombia 20 years ago, when you had uniform-clad, gun-toting guerrilla and paramilitary armies roaming the Colombian countryside. Likewise, Colombia is and has historically been a cocaine production country, whereas Ecuador is a transit country. And so the geography of violence in the country looks different and takes place in different localities than it did historically in Colombia. And so in that case, I think that some of the best lessons from the Merida Initiative, which was largely a countering transnational organized crime effort, are instructive for how the United States and its Ecuadorian partners might implement a concerted partnership strategy to deal with Ecuador's current crisis. And there, I would say one of the lessons that we learned in Mexico was that a kingpin strategy, or trying to remove the the head of organized crime groups or gangs tended to make the problem of violence a whole lot worse because it created an atomization of organized crime and inspired groups that were engaged in their own rivalries to try to consolidate power over new organizations or new territory. And so one of the more successful methods or strategies that Mexico and the United States pursued, which delivered some of the most propitious victories during the Merit Initiative, in fact, had to do with financial intelligence and going after cartels and the folks who protect those cartels in society and disrupting their financial flows. Likewise, a major lesson from the Merit Initiative, also from Plan Colombia, but has unique applicability today in Ecuador, is building out an interagency or a whole of government strategy for dealing with crime and violence. Crime and violence will not be solved only exclusively through a military strategy, but rather will require injects or inputs from across the executive agencies and departments in the Ecuadorian government. And for that, you need to build trust among them. And I think that's where the United States, in the conduct of background checks or in creating spaces for dialogue amongst institutions, can serve as a viable partner.
Yeah, it just seems that the war on drugs, for lack of a better word, or war on drugs 2.0 or whatever you want to call it, is so multifaceted that you see it being or coming out in different ways. Public security being one of those, I think, that's expressed in many countries in the region. I know in Chile, it's expressed in a challenging public security environment. And I'm assuming that it's that way in other countries of the region, but just want to get to one last question or one last issue with drugs and immigration set to being hot topics for the upcoming U.S. presidential election. It feels like Latin America could get the spotlight or a spotlight, probably not the biggest one. Probably immigration will be pretty relevant. But this discussion will probably happen in that context. And I just want to get a sense from your perspective, what do you think the right way would be to balance this political conversation? I mean, how we address the challenges on the ground in Latin America while also owning up to our part of the problem stateside. There's the demand and the supply. There's the push and pull always of this discussion. But just from your knowledge, from your expertise, what do you think the right way to talk about this is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the temptation or the risk, and particularly in election year, for us to distill a very complex and long historical relationship between the United States and the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean into two issues, drugs and immigration. But unfortunately, what that does is it moves the conversation from one about regional and even international challenges to one about the U.S.-Mexico relationship, which Mexico, by the way, is also in an election year, to a conversation about U.S.-Mexico relationship and, by extension, the U.S. border. And I think that betrays the complexity and betrays the nuance that is so essential to developing good policies for dealing with problems of drugs, migration, arms trafficking, et cetera, the things that fuel the crisis of violence, insecurity, and frankly, illegitimacy of institutions throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. Today, I think the U.S. executive branch is doing nearly everything within its power to address drug demand in the United States. And of course, the challenges of migration, both at its root, and we've long undertaken, now almost a decade in, undertaken an effort to address the root causes of migration in Central America and broadly speaking throughout Latin America. But until Congress decides to update legislation to meet the challenges and realities of today, vis-a-vis immigration and drugs, not those of yesterday, I'm not sure we can expect major wins. And on the security assistance front, unfortunately, because we're of the polarized political moment which we find ourselves in, which security assistance in more pressing contexts like the Middle East or Ukraine is becoming highly politicized, I don't think that we're going to see any robust support coming down the pike for major security assistance efforts in Latin America and the Caribbean, at least not on the magnitude of Plan Colombia and the Merit Initiative, which were multi-billion-dollar efforts that took place over 10 years. And unfortunately, the U.S. government will wait until there's a real problem or crisis before it seeks to respond with a robust security assistance package. And by that point, it's often too late.
Yep. Yep. And it's always crisis driven. That's exactly right.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, this is obviously the issue in the region right now. It's driving local elections, national elections. It's driving to a large degree the American election. So I think, you know, we couldn't have touched on a more topical, your book could not have touched on a more topical issue. And I just really want to thank you for sharing with us your thoughts and the really excellent book, which hopefully will influence future administrations. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Very much appreciate the opportunity.
And folks, don't forget the book, From Peril to Partnership, U.S. Security Assistance and the Bid to Stabilize Colombia and Mexico. And Paul, where can folks access the book?
The book is available in ebook on Kindle, on Amazon, or you can order physical copies either through Oxford University Press, Amazon, or your local bookseller.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you once again.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Americas Today, our podcast for anyone and everyone interested in the Americas. We hope you enjoyed this episode and the unique insights we aim to deliver every week. For now, we're signing off and wishing you a great day.